Okay, here we go. Nice and quiet.
Sound speeds, camera rolling.
Holding for sound.
Last looks. Calling for last looks.
And set and action.
I need to swap batteries.
You know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome to Making Movies is Hard, the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Russell, the founding host of the podcast. I've been crewing up on sets for over 10 years. I made dozens of films, shorts, and features as either a producer or a director. And my first feature film as a writer and director of The Alternate is premiering at the Dances with Films Film Festival this Saturday, September 11th. You can't get your tickets because by the time this airs, it'll have already happened. And I won't be a bundle of nerves anymore. It'll be great.
We're talking to the future. That's insane.
Exactly.
Well, I hopefully will be just as proud of you as I am now in a week from today when this episode will be out. I am Liz Manischel. I am a writer, director, producer with two features on which I did those three things. I am also a former film critic, a current distribution consultant, and I used to manage Sundance's Creative Distribution Initiative, and watch my second feature, Speed of Life, on Showtime.
I'll say it's very good. People should watch it. This week, we welcome writer-director Ben Hicknell on the show to talk about his latest film, What We Found, and how he moved from being an indie drama filmmaker to making more of a genre film, and how the film was put together, and ultimately how it did in the marketplace. Ben is a five-time feature filmmaker, so we also dig into how he gets his films off the ground in the first place, and how he is able to make a living as a filmmaker, which is amazing. By the time this airs, my film The Alternate will have premiered, and I have some final questions for Liz about the importance of going to film festivals, and how to stay sane when you feel like you're about to puke from anxiety over your premiere, which is how I feel right now. Lastly, if we have time, we will finally answer this listener question we've been pushing off for weeks, which I hope we get to because it's a good one. And also, are you an emerging or working writer? Then you should check out the International Screenwriters Association. The ISA is an organization designed to connect writers with filmmakers through a number of programs they offer, including publishing your logline to a network of industry professionals, consultation courses, contests, and their top 25 writers list, which features some of the best writers that are part of their network. So head over to www.networkisa.org to sign up for free today. And without anything else to say and no more mess ups, here's our talk with Ben Hicknell. Ben Hicknell, welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for joining us today. Give us the elevator pitch for What We Found for those who didn't listen to your bonus episode from months ago.
Okay, sure. Yeah. What We Found is a teen murder mystery. It's kind of Stand By Me meets The Wire. It's set in Baltimore, where I grew up, and two movies slash show that I love very much. And yes, essentially, it's the story of Marcus and Holly, two young best friends who are just starting their senior year of high school. Or sorry, starting their freshman year of high school. They're just starting high school. They're 14 years old. And a friend of theirs who's a senior disappears. And they try to, in West Baltimore, and they try to find out what happened to her. So it kind of borrows from Stand By Me and The Wire and from my childhood. And I was trying to write a fast moving kind of mystery. I've used the word thriller, and I found that's a misnomer because people then expect like John Wick, and it's not that. It's more of a mystery. But I was trying to write a fast moving, exciting movie after doing a bunch of character dramas. But it still has kind of the heart of it has kind of an indie heart with a lot of character moments as well. So that's the movie. And I'm really proud of the kind of young cast and how it turned out. So yeah, it was great to release it last year.
Thumbnailing 15 questions from that. How many days did you shoot?
That one, well, that's a funny story again, you know, because it always comes down to funding, right? So we wanted to do 25, and then we didn't have the money for that. So we ended up shooting principal in a crazy 18 days, 3 6-day weeks, because that's all we could kind of get. And if you see the movie, I mean, literally they say like, don't do children, water, or animals. We literally have like several minors, like, because we cast actual 14-year-olds too. We didn't do 18-year-olds as 14-year-olds. We did 14-year-olds. So we could only shoot like so many hours a day. So we had minors. We had a major water scene. If you see the movie, you'll see that. And we even had a scene with the dog. So we did everything not supposed to do. We did it in 3 weeks, which was crazy. But that then meant that we did have to do pickups. So we raised some more money later on to fill in some things and reshoot a few things, and did 4 days of pickups that were instrumental to finishing the film. And, you know, originally, if we had done 25 days, we wouldn't need to do that. But that's indie filmmaking, is we just didn't have the money at the time. We needed to go. So we did what we could. And then we had to fix some things. But I think, you know, I think in some ways that worked out well, too, because for some of the cast, young cast was very experienced. Some of them, it was their first movie. So I think it gave a few of the younger cast also a chance to kind of like get a second stab at some beats. And that was helpful. That's my cat. That's Charlie. He's my director's assistant. He'll be here.
What was the rough budget of the film?
In the end, it's between 600 and 700,000. Under a million. Oh, you want to edit that? Do we just say under a million?
Well, it's up to you. We want that. We want you to not edit that. We'd like to keep
if
that.
It's already sold and the deals are done, who cares, right?
Everybody knows. And actually it was funny because I kind of tried to play it coy, and distributors are kind of smarter now. Like, I tried to play it coy, and then in a few discussions, I was kind of like, under a million. They were like, yeah, we're guessing around 600,000. And I was, you know, like they kind of can tell now, you know? So anyway, yeah, that's what it was. So that's the real deal.
How did you and Charlie come up with the idea?
I might lock him out in a second. Anyway. So like I said, I'd done at that point, depending on how you count my movies, two or three character dramas. And, you know, a lot of my discussions after making these movies with distributors was like, you know, it's well made, we like it. Oh, you're in South by Southwest, great. But, you know, dramas are hard to sell and not big enough names and et cetera. So I was like, I want to try to do what I do, but do it in a quote unquote, for lack of a better term, more commercial way. So it did start with not a cold calculation, but it kind of started more conceptually. You know, it started with, it started as a type of movie. And I was like, I literally remember at the premiere of A Rising Tide in Seattle, which was great. It was fun, but it was like 9 o'clock on a Friday. And, you know, my South by Southwest premiere for Lebanon, PA had been like packed and sold out. Right. And then my second movie was like Seattle, 9 o'clock on a Friday, kind of rainy, like 2/3 full. And I just was like, man, like, you know, and I'm really proud of that film, too. I'm really not trying to like throw shade on my own films. It was just that I had a kind of moment of clarity at the after party. I was like, you know, people want to see certain kind of movies. And I was like, my next movie, I need to do something different. And I think said, like, after a few beers, I was like, my next movie, like end of act one, somebody's getting a bullet to the head, you know? And so that was kind of part of the, honestly, part of the inspiration, because, you know, don't want to spoil the movie, but there is a murder. There are murders involved. So that was kind of how it started. And then, so when I was like 13 years old, I used to go camping all the time with my friends. It was kind of our little escape. We would like go skate. We would skateboard off to like the state park, Patapsco State Park in Baltimore, and go camping. And don't tell the park service. We would like, you know, spend the night and go skinny dipping the river. And like, you know, like you're not supposed to be there after dark and stuff. But so those experiences kind of informed this movie, where these kids they go camping in the woods. They're looking for a body in the woods, kind of like Stand By Me. So it kind of became this mystery and this kind of thriller, but also a statement about what it was like for me growing up. Marcus is a young kind of nerdy kid. He's a young nerdy kid who takes a moral stance. And that's kind of the kind of kid I was. I was the kind of kid in like middle school who'd be like, but it's not right, you know, like talking about like, you know, illegal wars, or like, you know, I was very into social justice and moral issues. And so when I was writing Marcus, he's also this young kind of nerdy kid who's kind of in a lot of ways like dismissed by his peers, but, you know, he's not like, not that's anything wrong with play football. You know, he's not doing some of this stuff like other kids do, normal kids do. He is really interested in these bigger issues. And so then when this person he knows disappears, and a lot of the other kids at the high school are kind of like, you know, man, that sucks. You know, they're not worried, but they're not like, I'm going to do something about it. And he has this kind of moral compass. He's just like, no, like, I know her. I need to do something about this. And so him and Holly, who's his kind of other more nerdy friend, they go and try to find out what happened to her on their own. And there's a storyline with the police, and there's maybe some corruption there. So there's kind of a reason too, why they think maybe the police aren't really quite looking into the way they should. So anyway, so it really comes from that. It came from my childhood experiences and that sense of morality. And that kind of, in a wonderful way, kind of simple morality you can have as a child, where you're just like, this is not right. I'm going to do something. And that's kind of Marcus's thrust, you know, that's what sets him on this path.
And then how long did you spend working on the film from, you know, coming up with the idea to it being released?
Yeah, I don't know. A million years? No, I mean, it was started writing it in kind of 2016. We shot it in 2015, 2016, then fundraising. I mean, it's still always the hardest part of the movie. It used to take me a long, long time. Now I do have some funding connections, and it took me about a year and a half to kind of fundraise and get, but like I said, we didn't then have as much as we needed, but you know, so it kind of, in one way it went on for years. So we went through the whole process, but about a year and a half to get it ready to shoot. Shot in 2018, shot in 2017, then did some pickups in 2018, had to wait. We edited and waited for the weather to change to do the pickups because we went into winter, so we had to wait for like the spring to come again. Did those pickups and then finished the movie around early 2019, and then it came out in 2020. So you know, it actually was like a 3 or 4 year journey, which some of my movies were like 5 or 6, so that wasn't as crazy.
One of my questions later. And I think I might have heard you wrong, but you said something about 2015, 2016. That's when you wrote the script, right?
Because Rising Tide premiered in 2015. So like I said, that party was Seattle, like summer 2015. So it was probably the germ, the seed was there. And then probably 2016 was like in earnest writing. Yeah. And then by end of 2016 was like starting to fundraise and stuff. And then we got it shot in mid 2016. We got it shot in 2017. Late 2017.
The last of our rapid fire questions is, compared to all the other films you've ever done, how difficult was this one?
This was, I mean, they're each different in different degrees, right? But this is, in general, was the hardest shoot I'd ever had. And there are a number of reasons for that. And some I won't go into because it has to do with like personalities and stuff, you know, not with any of the cast. The cast was like lovely, but there was some behind the scenes stuff happening. And then it was, a big part of it was this money shortage, that we thought we had more money than we did and had to really scramble at the end to like figure out how to make it happen. And that meant cutting the schedule and cutting scenes. It really was like this, like, you know, like boot camp, or this kind of thing of just like, we are going to make this movie happen by any means necessary. And we, you know, buckled down and did, and we did, and I'm really proud of it. But it was a grueling shoot. It was crazy. Like every movie I lose a few pounds, like during prep, you know, just from the complete busyness and lack of, and stress and like lack of time to like, eat and be a human. So, I mean, I don't know how many, I guess it's like a meter of like how many pounds you lose during like prep. And so this was like an 8 pounder. I don't know. It was something, but it was crazy stressful. But then when we were shooting, you know, we had an amazing camera team because we had to move fast. We only had 3 weeks, right? So the camera team was amazing. The cast was amazing. People really pulled in and made it happen. And I'm really grateful for that.
So I'm really curious, like, you've made 5 feature films. You know, you like seem to be a career feature film maker, which is amazing. Is this what you do to pay the bills and everything? Or do you have other jobs that you do on the side?
Mostly, yeah. I mean, actually, and I thought you'd ask that question. I think I used to, in the past, like, you know, try to be more, you know, you try to create, because Hollywood's like all this illusion. You try to create this air of success, and like you try to like, I don't know. But these days, I just feel like it's good to be honest and like screw it. Like, we're all working so hard. I mean, your podcast is about how hard this is, and like everybody's working hard and hustling. So I'll answer honestly and not hiding in the unvarnished truth. But I used to work day jobs all the time. I had a day job, even when I made Lebanon PA, up until I shot Backwards, I had a full-time day job, or more than one, you know, lots of different things. I've been working since I was like 15. I was like washing dishes, like, you know, off the books, like legally. Like, I've just always, I'm not from like money. I've always worked. So always worked gigs and jobs. When I did Backwards, my second movie, or my third movie, depending on how you count it, I got paid like a directing check. I mean, because Lebanon PA, I got paid myself $1, right? I worked a full-time day job, paid myself $1, edited the movie like nights and weekends, all that kind of stuff. Or actually days and weekends, because I was working a night job. Backwards let me leave that job. And I haven't had to go back to a full-time job since, which is great. That was 2011. So it's been a decade of basically directing full-time. And so I, you know, direct, I write, I edit. So I've taken other gigs. You know, I've edited commercials. I've edited other narrative projects, like other films and shorts. I did a book trailer for Penguin Books. Like, I definitely do a lot of cool gigs and stuff. But I don't, you know, some filmmakers I know, I mean, some are now like directing TV and making like hundreds of thousands of dollars, and that's amazing. And other ones I know, you know, they do like branded content on the side, and they have a good steady thing. I really focus my time on independent filmmaking, so I do a lot of weird gigs. So basically I'll do video gigs, and then sometimes, I mean, like in the last few years, like, I've driven Uber, you know, like I've definitely, you know, I've had to hustle. It's not like I get to sit back and rest on my laurels, but I do, you know, I actually wrote, in the last few years, I've written 3 different scripts for hire for other people, which has been fantastic, and, you know, getting paid for it. So that's been great. And obviously I work on my films, and now I build in like some money for myself on my film. So, but I'm always hustling. But you know, and then the funny thing too, is like, an indie film is how much time you spend on the business side and, you know, like fundraising and promoting and stuff versus like actually making films. So I definitely, too, even when I'm working on my films, yeah, often I'm lucky enough to get to like write for a day, and that's great. But other times I'm doing admin, and, you know, I'm doing like the books. So my old, you know, I still do like, we're still trying to finish the New York tax credit for What We Found. And like, I'm the accountant, you know, So I do spend a lot of time working on my films as a producer and as kind of the owner of the LLC versus just being like a director dreaming up stuff. So yeah, you know, but I also consider myself fortunate that I do get to work on my films a good amount of my time. And that's been my full-time job for 10 years, which is awesome.
I want to talk a little bit about what you said about genre, because it's actually what you did is what I'm trying to do. After like doing dramedies and character-based pieces and personal films, I'm like, wait a second, this is not making me any money. Like, I'm going to try to level up commercially in a different way. And I guess looking at your CV, and just by what you said, you're very impressive, very prolific. Do you feel like you've been consistently leveling up? And B, do you think this turn into genre has helped you?
It's weird. The business is very schizophrenic and fickle. So back when I made Lebanon PA, which was came out in 2011, it was a total character drama. And at that point, everybody I met with some managers and agents and stuff, and they were like, oh, you know, this is great, but like, you know, you're kind of like a Tom McCarthy figure. You know, he doesn't really make us any money. He's like prestige. He's like getting us Oscars. He's like, you know, so they were like, you should really kind of lean into genre, and like, there's no space for drama in movies anymore. But that was before the streaming boom and all the drama like series blew up. So the funny thing is, I feel like one of the biggest successful paths for an indie filmmaker now is make a really cool, idiosyncratic, personal movie, and then make a TV, make a series out of it for like a streamer. But that didn't exist yet. So the funny thing is, I feel like I pivoted. So that's all I'm saying is that I was told, do something more commercial. So then I did A Rising Tide, which was more, it was still a character drama, but it was more of like a romance. It was a foodie movie. It's about a chef. So it was about like beautiful food and romance set at the Jersey Shore. And that was my more commercial, still a drama, more commercial drama. And that actually, you know, did pretty well in certain ways. We actually turned a profit on that movie, which is like awesome. And made me and my investors very happy and proud. But it didn't make like a big splash with industry people or anything. And so then what we found was me leaning into genre. And the very funny thing is, once that hit the distributors and we were pitching it and stuff, the two things we heard was that it was too mainstream, wasn't idiosyncratic enough for like, especially for the festivals and some of the more like really indie distributors. And then the more mainstream people were just we got somebody to watch it at Netflix through a friend, which was great. And they watched it, and their main thing was, yeah, it's great. It's too low budget. And that's a funny thing. We're like, because, you know, when Netflix makes like, you know, a low budget Netflix movie, like, oh, no stars. And it's like a teen movie at a high school, because our movie was a teen movie at high school. They spent $15 million. You know, our movie was. So the basic thing was, they were like, oh, it's well made. Yeah. Good performances. You know, yeah, good watch. But, you know, it just doesn't represent it's too low budget for our brand. So the funny thing is, I feel like no matter what you make, the industry tells you something kind of, they want something different. And so I definitely, this next movie I'm writing is commercial, but is also, I'm kind of going for it more and just being as personal as I can be, because I feel like in a nice way, that's one way the business has changed with streaming, is people are finding more niche audiences. And so you're able to just, they want distinct voices, and that's a positive as a filmmaker. So anyway, so I think the funny thing is, so Liz asked if it had helped me. And I mean, the answer is not really, because each time they kind of want a different thing. It was very funny. It was like, especially the film festivals were just like, you know, because I have relationships with some of them, because I've been at some of them, and they were just like, I'm like, oh, it was a fun watch. We really liked it. They're like, but it's just too mainstream for a festival. And then the distributors were kind of like, it's without repeating myself, it's a very funny thing. And you have to think about what will find an audience and what distributors, et cetera, want. But also, they don't really know what they want. So I think you always, it is true that you have to just stick to yourself and your voice and make something that that has a strong voice, and that's, you know, that then hopefully it'll find its people.
Do you feel though that you are leveled up? Like, what is, do you like, I know that's just esoteric, but do you feel like you are?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like each movie gets better, you know? That's something I like, is I feel like I'm very proud of what we found. And I think for lack of a better term, for the average person watching that movie, it's my best movie. It moves the fastest, it's the smoothest in terms of like performances, it has the most twists, it's just the most fun to watch. But I think Lebanon, PA, which is set in like rural Pennsylvania and is about a young girl who gets pregnant and is kind of deciding whether or not to have an abortion, is this very like personal film, and it's a little more idiosyncratic because my extended family is all from central Pennsylvania. So I had all these little, and I wish I even had more touches. That's a whole other story about the production of that film. But you know, I have these little personal touches. So I think in some ways though, that movie still, it depends on the audience member, but like, I think indie film people, especially when they see that movie, they feel like that's my purest. I have friends who watch and they go, that's you, that's your purest movie. So it's funny, but I feel personally that I do get better with each movie. And that's, you know, that's a good feeling, because you want to develop as an artist, you want to push yourself. And each movie, I try to push myself in a different way. And I do feel that, you know, each movie gets better. Of course, whether the industry, whether people find it is a very different question. But yeah.
So we're a year out of what we found coming out, roughly. Like, how has it done business wise? Like, have you gotten a return on your investment? Like, you know, has it at least proven to some extent that like genre is, you know, going to pay better than drama?
Well, I don't really know if that's the case anymore because of streaming and because of, you know, these series where yes, there isn't like box office, but they get viewers, they get a lot of cultural attention, and streamers pay a lot for them. So I'm not saying that's totally a thesis, you know, in terms of filmmaking, but yeah, I mean, audiences found it. I mean, we haven't, what we found, audiences found it. We haven't made like a profit yet. Obviously that's going to take some time and hopefully we'll get there. But the first quarter was strong. And we estimated, cause it's hard. You don't really get, you just get money numbers and you have to extrapolate like, well, okay, like what's the share of who's getting what share, what, you know, 60% versus 40%, et cetera. Like who's getting what share of that dollar value. Anyway, so we kind of extrapolated and guessed a 250,000 people or so into the movie the first quarter, which is awesome for a movie with, you know, we spent a few hundred bucks on Facebook ads and I was like full-time social mediaing for 2 months, but we didn't have a major festival. We were originally going to open in LA and Baltimore in theaters to get some press and try to drive that. Theaters were shut. So we played a few theaters in kind of like far corners, like Florida and Washington State and like Maine, like places that were open, but not like the big cities. But yet we broke through and like 250,000 people rented it the first quarter. So it's, you know, it has money coming in. I've already sent checks back to the investors for a chunk for the first quarter. So yeah, you know, I think for an indie film, it's definitely pretty successful and on a path to hopefully keep, we're doing some foreign deals now. It just sold to several territories. So yeah, it's getting out there, and that's, you know, I'm very proud of that. It's a lot of work.
And you did like, you know, orchestrated like a re-release, right? Recently, or I don't know how you worded it in your, but can you tell us about that?
Of A Rising Tide?
Damn it. It was A Rising Tide. It wasn't what we thought.
It was A Rising Tide. Yeah.
Okay. On the show weeks ago, I misinformed everyone. And I was like, well, I think Ben's doing this like re-release thing. And I totally swapped the titles. Okay. Well, so you're re-releasing Rising Tide then. That's really interesting.
So A Rising Tide made money. So we had Seattle and then we had a good festival run. And then what we did is we got a foreign TV deal for A Rising Tide, which was wonderful because we basically sold it in this foreign TV package that made us back. Like actually we got an MG. We got an MG, made back like half the budget on like, you know, signing the contract, half the budget back. And then over time made more. And basically it was a very good foreign TV deal. So it was on pay TV, you know, like premium cable, Sky and HBO equivalent, et cetera, around the world. But it never really had much of a US release. We had a small US distributor who picked it up and basically did like some streaming stuff with it, not like Hulu and Netflix, but like, you know, streaming with ads on like Tubi and Pluto and Amazon Prime and et cetera. And they just weren't doing much with it. So then we actually got the distributor of What We Found, because we had a good relationship there and we were getting on so well, they were like, we'll put it out. And so they put it out on like a bunch of platforms just last month. July came out, early July. So we're still trying to promote that a bit. And it's just great because, like, you know, it's a US-based movie. It's so A Rising Tide is, because I haven't described that one yet. is a love story in a foodie movie about a community rebuilding set after Hurricane Sandy in Atlantic City, New Jersey. At that time, I was living in Philadelphia. I used to spend a lot of time down the shore. Again, I like to set things not like in, I mean, not that I never will, but like outer space or New York. I like to set things in like kind of smaller, more idiosyncratic parts of America that aren't seen as film on film as often, and often a place I have a personal connection to. So this was set at the Jersey Shore, and it was set after Hurricane Sandy. And I think actually it really is a great kind of parable for the COVID times, because it's really about how a community comes together and tries to heal and rebuild, and especially how the different strata of that, there's kind of an economic message, the different strata of that community need to come together. And that unless every strata kind of is part of the community and engages, then the network of the community falls apart. So anyway, so that's what it's about. And the public, a lot of people really hadn't seen it because it's on just these few little streaming services. So now that it's on everything, I'm actually finding messages from people and stuff are like, oh, I saw it. It was great. It was on Showtime in the US. So like our funders and et cetera saw it when it was running on Showtime in the US, but a lot of people hadn't seen it. So we're finding a new audience, and that's been really nice. Give it new life.
So, you know, you mentioned, your investors on What We Found. This is the question I ask everybody. How did you find your investors? Like, are these people who invested in your older movies? This is like a whole new group of investors. Like, how did this come together?
I don't know if I'm repeating other people. I mean, my theory on indie film investment in the US, because indie film investment in the US is very different from, you know, if you're in Europe or Canada, there's more established pathways, there's public funding, you know, the national lottery in the UK, et cetera. So then you have these more established pathways. In America, they're really, because we love our freedom, there isn't really an established pathway. It comes down to basically begging rich people for money. That's the American model, for lack of a better term. And luckily, you know, some rich people are very nice and care about the arts and are interested in investing or donating to movies. And I find in general, this is a generalization, but in general, there are three ways indie films get funded. First, there's the I'm in that sphere way of like, you know, someone's rich uncle's, you know, it's the son, daughter, niece, nephew of either somebody wealthy or somebody kind of connected, like a famous, you know, movie, something like that. And you look at like Sundance, et cetera, and, you know, I really feel like almost half the indie films or more are funded in that model, where someone knows someone and it's like, wow, your first movie was $4 million. Where'd you get that? And it's like, yeah, you know, it was Aunt Janice, you know, or whoever, Uncle Ted. So there's that model. Then there are established production companies, you know, like these awesome, you know, like Killer Films and et cetera, who do find new voices and new talent and get movies made. And they're kind of the awesome, like, I don't know, Valkyries, like riding on, you know, like fighting for indie film. But I really feel like that's a very, very small percentage of films. Only so many of them, they only make so many films. And then also too, they tend to work with the same filmmakers. So they find some new talent. Yes, they do, but often they make, you'll see, you know, they work with the same director again and again and again. So then after that person's first film, it's really not like finding new talent. Anyway, so that's like, I don't know, 10% of films. And then I'm in that final 25-30% of the, like, I come from, you know, I know it's everybody in America says a middle class, but I come from a middle class family. I had like no family connections to money, you know, so people like us, and I'm sure Liz is very similar actually, just kind of nail it together, you know, like literally, like it's like you put the ship together piece by piece. And so I literally raise money in, you know, $2,500 chunks, $5,000 chunks, $50,000 chunks, $100,000 chunks. And the way I got started was my first years out of college, I was doing theater in the Philadelphia area. I lived in Philly for the first like decade after college. And I was basically doing like the Fringe Festival and doing local Philadelphia theater, et cetera. And through that, I met Philadelphia has a kind of longtime culture of philanthropy, and there's kind of like some old money there, et cetera. And people there do support the arts and these theater companies. So I met people through that basically, like, you know, like I was acting in a play or like assistant directing a play and like opening night gala, you know, you have the people who, like, when you look in the back of the program, the, like, you know, the founder circle and the, et cetera, those people who like supported the arts in Philadelphia, I met some of them through that. And that was how I got started. Is then I did a first tiny movie. So if you count my movies, if you count me as having to do five movies, my first movie was a tiny little $10,000 movie called Cellar. $10,000 is a lot, but it's also, it's not a lot for a movie. And I played some festivals and stuff, but never got released because it was just a very small movie. But the way I did that was some of the people who I had met who donated to theater companies, et cetera, we actually produced it through a theater company, but did this weird like film theater hybrid and got some donations. And that was my first experience. And then when I did Lebanon, PA, I expanded on some of those contacts because that first little movie, Cellar, did well. It actually won a Barrymore Award, which is the Philadelphia Theater Awards. So you haven't heard of it in LA, but in Philadelphia, it's like the biggest, like one of the biggest arts things. We won an award, we got attention, you know, et cetera. It did well. Played the Philadelphia Film Festival, won like the best local film that year. And so off of that, then I started making Lebanon, PA, which is another Pennsylvania-based film. And that movie ended up being over 300,000. We started off trying to do it for about $250,000, and I got some donations, some investments, and then Lebanon, PA was, I mean, we were riding completely on the seat of our pants. I mean, a quarter of the movie was on my credit cards. So when it come time to finish that movie and like sell that movie, it was like life or death. Like I had to get that movie released or I had this massive amount of debt. So, you know, it was since then I've just been always been so intricately involved with the movies. You know, I just get it done and it's not like, yeah, I don't get that angel check for like $3 million from someone. It's never had that happen.
So just to kind of like get into the nitty gritty of this a little bit more, it's like you met some contacts through the theater world, you made a movie, it did pretty well. And then you just met more people through that basically. But like,
yeah. Cause then suddenly, okay, you're in the newspaper and like, you know, you're a filmmaker. And then, so through some of the money people, I met other money people, also through, you know, through cold contacts, it's not like they all came to me. You know, I was definitely, as I was making Lemon and PA, I was reaching out to everybody I could through any connection I could. So it was me seeking people out, either cold calling or emailing or kind of, yes, meeting someone through a person. And then some, one of my investors for Lebanon, PA did find me because, I can't remember exactly, but we got some newspaper articles and she then contacted me. I think there was some kind of mutual connection, but she contacted me because she was like, I'm really interested in this. Can we talk about it? And we had lunch. And then, you know, afterwards she was like, well, I'd like to like invest in your movie. And that was great. But again, that was like a $25,000 check. You know, it's not like, it's bit [S2] Right. [S1] By bit by bit. So my Lebanon, PA is about 2.5 years of fundraising of just chasing money. And, you know, you get it turned down more often than you get a yes, obviously.
I remember when you're go on.
Sorry. When you're cold calling, like who are you cold calling? Like, and where are you finding these people to cold call? Are you cold calling production companies, like managers, like, or is it like actually individuals who you think may have money and may be interested in supporting the arts? Like how did you find your list to like even do those cold calling emails or calls?
Yeah. So for that movie, especially for that size, it was private equity and literally, and this was, 2000 and the wilds of 2007 or 8. So it literally started with like literally a notepad, like a piece of paper, a legal pad. And I just wrote down everybody I'd met, mostly in the Philadelphia theater kind of community, but also anybody I'd met who had money, connections to money, who might be interested in the arts. I just literally made a list. And then, yeah, started, you know, not cold calling like someone's, you know, home or, but kind of through emails, writing polite, you know, kind of brief, trying to be brief, you know, emails, but with a little bit of passion saying, you know, would you consider getting coffee with me? I'm trying to, you know, I've done this, I've won these awards in this thing, I'm trying to make a new project. I am introduced to this person, whatever, would you get coffee with me in chat? And you know, you get a lot of no's and then I got a few yeses and then you try to turn that coffee meeting into, and the main thing too is to not, I think, and I'm sure you guys have kind of heard about this too, but you know, you try to have a relationship with people. Like, you know, you can't force someone into investing in your movie and you can't, I always try to offer something, you know what I mean? And I know I can't offer that much, but I always try to like get to know the person. Usually there's a reason there has to be a reason they want to invest because they know it's, their investments are in stocks and real estate. They're doing this because they either care about the subject matter of your movie. Maybe they, and this often happens, they have a son or daughter who like wants to act or wants to edit, or so, you know, we definitely have people who came and like were our edit assistant or like gave a few lines in the movie. Like, you know, you try to involve them in a way that and also sometimes too, you know, they just care about the arts and they kind of want to be involved, they want to be on set, they want to meet, you know, meet the actors and see how it works and etc. And you know, for this person, $50,000, you know, is very similar to like if I ask my parents for like $500 because like my car got, you know, it's just they're on a different scale. It's someone of means who for them, $25,000, $50,000 is not is not that a crazy amount of money. So it's I mean, I wish there was a, because this is the golden question everybody asks. My next movie, I'm trying to do a bigger movie, so I am trying to pitch more to production companies. And it's not that I didn't pitch to production companies before, but I find an indie film often there's this weird chicken egg thing where most of the production companies, where Rising Tide went out to production companies, a lot of them basically, like, you know, they want you to be 90% of the way there. They're like, well, if you have all the money and you have the actors attached and you're about to shoot, then sure, we'll fund you. But like, you have, so in the end, I end up just kind of doing it myself. Not, you know, just because that's the only way it can happen. And I wish there was a better answer, like, be like, yes, you know, you go to this book and there's a list of names and there's a process. Right. But that's what I'm saying about America. There isn't any process. It is just going out and bit by bit, for me anyway. I mean, maybe there is once you get to, like, you know, production companies and you're doing a $5 million movie and you have a manager who's like, I don't know, I'm sure there is. But so far in my career, it's been by any means necessary, bit by bit.
And I just want to say really quickly that, like, I did the exact same thing. And I think that that is the game plan. That is the process, is like, write down a list of everyone you know who has money and then just start there and branch out. And I tell that to people and they look at me with a blank face, like, really? And I'm like, yeah, really? It'll take you like 3 or 4 years, but eventually you'll get there.
Well, I just remember, Ben, that, like, a few years ago, you very kindly met me, I think, at work. And I was like, please tell me the secret of your ways. And you shared this story. And I remember I was like, you just ask them for money. And you're like, yeah. I mean, like, you develop a relationship, but you're direct with what you need. And it was mind blowing to me that you would just say exactly what you needed in a conversation. And I think a lot of people are fearful of saying what they want in those kind of scenarios. They don't want to offend, they don't want to burn bridges, and there's something very scary about it. So I'm just, if you can kind of speak to that, because I'm sure you've also had to answer this question before too. It's like, how do you get past the barrier of just saying, I need the support, I need the money, to someone like that?
Well, again, I don't think I've ever talked to anyone who hasn't already done this in some capacity. You know, it's someone who's invested in another movie or has, you know, they already donate, you know, $100,000 a year to X theater company, et cetera, because, you know, they have the means and they care about the art. So for me, it was never this kind of extraordinary thing, and you know, as in it was like coming out of nowhere. And like I said, you try to develop a relationship first, you know, it's people who, and once you're doing the first one is the hardest, because then you have no track record. And you also have no, like, some of the people I met for my later films, I met, you know, through other films. So, like, you know, then you're at the Philadelphia Film Festival, for instance, in Philadelphia, or I didn't meet anybody at South by Southwest, but an example would be you're at South by Southwest and you're chatting at the after party with someone. And it's like, oh, you know, this person invested in that film. Yeah. Oh, well, I made this film. And they're like, oh, I saw that. I loved it. I mean, there's a natural thing there where if they're already into this in general, they're into film, they love cinema, they've already invested in things. And now you're at this, like, again, this didn't happen at South by, I wish it had, but, you know, that's a natural thing. So it's become more natural. At the beginning, it was, but then again, like I said, you know, my first movie I did for $10,000. So that's a lot of money, but in some ways that was a few donations of like $2,500. Like, and then some, like, I literally threw a fundraising party where it was like, you know, $50 a pop, people came and paid $50. And like, I had, you know, beer and I, you know, we did a little show and stuff, but, so again, like a big spectrum, but the point was I already did that. And that then proved I could do this. I did it. There was a finished film. I could give you a DVD. It had won awards for Philadelphia, a major award. It had won, like, you know, this major award. We'd gotten like stories in the Philadelphia City paper and mentions, you know, in the Inquirer. So I don't know. So it is building, it's proving you can do it. It's then convincing someone with your passion that you have a vision for this thing, but you have to find people who are already interested in this and have some kind of reason to want to be involved. And then, yes, it's about, like, if you meet someone, the first thing you say is, you know, hey, give me a check for $50,000. That's never going to, you have to kind of, you know, so again, if someone has a natural interest, that's what I mean. I don't mean it in a cynical way. I'm not trying to manipulate. I really try to give them something. Cause I know that it's, that's kind of what they want out of it. So very often I try to find what that person wants. And so, you know, sometimes it's an issue. Like, I care about, I actually didn't find anyone for Lebanon PA who was like, I am so strongly pro-choice. I want to see a movie made about this, but you know, that would have been a natural thing of someone being like, I care about this issue. I think the one woman I mentioned who I met, you know, I think she probably, when she read the script, she probably responded to that. You know, I think she probably liked that, but we didn't really discuss that as like the main reason. The main reason was she had kind of, you know, loved movies and had never been on a set before and kind of thought it'd be fun to be a part of it, you know, and she, I definitely have a lot of investors who I think honestly never read the whole script. They might read a little packet. Maybe they read a page, I don't know, you know, and they maybe come by set once or they never come at all. You know, she was someone who, she was on set almost every day. She was, you know, there and was a part of it. And so there was a natural reason why she wanted to do this, you know, and she was, you know, someone who was, I don't think she wasn't as wealthy as some of my investors, you know, but she was like, retired and in like her 60s. And, you know, it was kind of a fun thing to do. And she had the means where, you know, that investment wasn't a crazy thing to do. And then that was her like fun summer, like hanging out with us on the film set. And she came to South by Southwest and everything. So, you know, so did that answer your question? Sorry, I feel like I'm talking, but it literally, there isn't. So in a half an hour lunch conversation, it's about having a conversation with them as a person. And there isn't like one magic moment where it's just kind of having a natural conversation that at some point saying, okay, well, I know you're interested in this. I have this project. I've explained it to you. And this is why I really feel it's important. And this is, you know, an important maybe message, an important story. This is our path to how we think we can do it. And, you know, would you consider, and then you just ask the question, would you consider investing $25,000? And then you see what they say, you know, they either say yes, no, or maybe.
I think what would console people is if you just say, or I mean, I don't want to lead you on, but if you just say whether you ever horrifically offended someone or it blew up in your face or it ever went very poorly, just saying exactly what you wanted.
Not really, but yeah, I mean, I can only think of one example. And I don't want to go into it because in case I don't want to like offend that person.
But that's one out of like many. So it sounds like the odds are fairly good.
And you do, I mean, people are usually kind of flattered. Again, you have to do it this way. You can't just ask up front. You have to kind of talk with the person, develop a relationship. And then usually people are kind of flattered. And then you target your asks, right? So if it's someone who's really wealthy, then maybe you are asking for, depends on the scale of your movie, $100,000 or, you know, $1 million, you know, or if it's someone who's not, you know, that wealthy, but you know they have some, like I said, then maybe it's $10,000, $20,000, whatever it is. And so, you know, in that way too, if you are showing, I think if they know you're coming at it from an honest place where you really care about this thing, and because people respond to ambition, you know, I think people respond to this sense of, here's a young, not that I'm so young anymore, here's a young person who's passionate and trying to do something. And yeah, and so it can't hurt to ask. And I really think you have to think about how you do it. And I think do it with an open heart. I guess that's my, which is esoteric, but I think is true, is if you're doing it in kind of like a, you expect something way, or in a, I don't know, if you're weird about it, it'll get weird. But if you ask with an open heart and you're just like, I really care about this, would you please consider being a part of this, being a part. And then always too, I always offer them to be a part of it. A lot of them don't come to set, but I'm always like, come, I don't say just give me money. I say, you know, come be a part of this thing. And I mean that, you know, they're part of the family because they're another, just like the crew and the cast and, you know, the investors are part of the family. And I try to involve them as family. They can come on set, then come to the premiere, you know, I try to involve them in the same way I involve other people.
Yeah, this is like, you're basically saying the exact same thing I would say if someone asked me the question. So it's like, it's really comforting to hear that it's like, I'm not doing anything different than anyone else. Like, this is what you have to do, you know?
But then there is that tough question of scaling up because that's the tough thing is, you know, certain people know people who can write $5 million checks and a lot of us don't. So then the question is how you scale up. And that's a whole other question.
I have one last question before we go to final five, but Alric, do you
go first, Liz. Okay.
You're having a baby soon.
I am.
It's coming out of you. And Alric just had a baby and it's been a topic. He came out of him too. And this has been a topic as of late. The idea of a balance is a myth, but how do you prepare? And then, you know, what's your plan? Can you talk a little bit about your plan?
Man, get as far as I can on this new movie before the baby comes. Is right now my kind of panic plan. I mean, you know much better than me because you guys are doing it. I'm not doing it yet. I think I'm probably over. I have a lot of friends who say, and actually Liz is one of those friends who said, like, it is possible. You just focus, you get stuff done, you have time with our napping, you have time with your partner, you know, whatever. Because right now I'm panicking that I'm never gonna have any time, you know. So I'm trying to relax and think, okay, there'll be some time. But obviously too, you're devoting a lot of your energy to this little creature. And so I'm not quite sure what'll happen. I'm trying to get this movie to a certain goalpost. I'm trying to get an active development before the kid's born, so then we can keep pushing it forward. But like, I have the production team on. We have some first money raised. We're kind of getting it moving. So that's what I'm trying to work on right now on my new film. And then, I mean, yeah, you know, I'm praying to God and to Joe Biden for this infrastructure plan, because honestly, it makes such a difference. Like, you know, childcare is a big thing. Like, if, you know, we have friends who pay like $2,800 a month for childcare in LA, right? So that's like another mortgage. So, you know, if we can 28? Find a place, yeah.
Is that for two children? Because that's no, insane for one. Oh my God.
That's for one, but you know, whatever. I mean, I'm sure they're cheap. So anyway, so if we end up finding something that's, you know, I just kind of do the math in my head of like, okay, we find a place that's more like $2,000 or $1,800. I mean, if you guys know some places, start
mine's
giving me
12,
names.
But it started out at 16 and an infant. I'm just saying, like, I got you in terms of my daycare.
I'm just saying it's crazy, but I'm saying, you know, if we can then pay whatever it is, $1,800, whatever, but then we're getting $500 or $600 a month from the government, you know, because they're talking about in this infrastructure bill. I mean, it's literally this infrastructure bill stuff. We're talking about movies, but it's really life or death. It's especially, I mean, and you look at like filmmaking, that makes such a difference. Because then, okay, then we get down to like $1,200 or so a month. That seems doable. You know, that's like, okay, so then we can have childcare and we can focus on work. When it's $2,800, it just seems like, God, that's so much. Right. It's rough. So we're hoping for childcare. We're going to support each other. My wife, luckily, she works for UCLA and they have a decent amount of, you know, maternity, et cetera. So, you know, we're kind of taking it as it goes. In the first few months, she'll be off for the first like 3 months at least. So she'll be here. I'll be here. We'll be figuring it out. And you know, and I don't know, but I think the long-term goal is just, I see people who are doing it, who are having a kid and still having a career. And so I'm going to try to figure that out and do the same thing. And I'm excited to have a kid. So I don't want to, you know, go into it thinking, oh man, it's either or. I feel like that's not a choice we should have to make as filmmakers, as artists, as people. So I'm going to try to find a balance. But yeah, I, you know, you're asking the wrong guy because I haven't had the kid yet. So ask me like next year and I'll let you know how it's going.
I came up with a final question. You know, you've raised money for 5 feature films. Does it get easier? Was it easier to raise money for the 5th than it was for the 2nd, for instance?
Yes, but scaling up is the big question. So this next movie I want to do for a few million dollars, like just because because of that Netflix. I mean, because this is a bigger story. I'm doing a climate change movie that I feel like is the best thing I've written, and I feel like is an important story to get made. But it's a bigger story, so it takes a little more money. So there are story reasons why, but also career wise, that Netflix answer of, oh, you made a great movie, good job, but you know it's not big enough. It doesn't cost enough. It doesn't look big enough. You know, you only have like 3 extras in that scene. You should have 100. You know, like that kind of stuff means also career wise that is the next step. And so that's my next question is, I could probably again go out with my contacts and raise a similar type budget, but how do I get to like 5 million or, you know, whatever. We're still trying to figure out exactly how much we need for this movie. That's the next question. And that's what I'm trying to work with. I'm trying to work with some other more established producers or production companies to kind of make this next movie happen. So yes, it gets easier, but it's not easier for me. I feel like actually this next movie could in some ways be the hardest one to do because I have to find this path to a bigger budget, and that's a new beast.
Wow. Awesome. Yeah, let's do final 5. I'll go first. What's the first film you ever made and how do you feel about it now?
First film I ever made. Okay. First feature or non-feature?
Can be anything.
I'm going to do first feature. The first feature I made was called Tough Cookies 3. I shot it junior, senior year of high school. It is a feature film. We shot on SVHS. That's Super VHS for you young people. Had a slightly better resolution or something. Not a bit rate.
Yeah, just a little bit, just a little bit better. Yeah, it's like what they use in broadcast at the time.
So we shot it on SVHS. I edited it deck to deck, and I'm really proud of it. And it's basically, there was a superhero team called the Tough Cookies. It's a long story. Clyde Sugarwater, Duncan Hines were some of the characters. I was Clyde Sugarwater. And it was basically me and my friends putting on bad kind of costumes and fighting bad guys. And crazy enough, it was a feature film. I mean, we shot this whole thing. It was a big project. We shot in our high school, obviously pre-Columbine. This is just a few years before Columbine. We had toy guns. we had a dummy. We had this one dummy that we threw, and luckily our school was supportive. So our vice principal Tanner, thank you, Jay Tanner. He let us shoot in this high school while there was like cleaning it for the summer. So we're like running down the hallways, like, you know, using a skateboard dolly, like me, like on the skateboard with the camera, like running down the hallway, doing action scenes, doing really bad fake kung fu. We had this one dummy that we threw off every time a person got, we threw it off the roof of the high school. So like anytime a guy got like kind of stabbed or shot or like thrown off the building or something, it was this dummy. We ran over with a car. It was crazy. And it was, you know, in some ways, you know, awful, but in some ways the best thing I'll ever make, because it was so pure. No lights, no, we literally had a boom mic duct taped to the end of a, I think one of those old yardstick rulers, like a full yardstick, and like with like a cord that went into the camera for like dialogue scenes when we needed like good audio. And then we unplugged that when we were doing action stuff. No lights, nothing else. And it's awesome. And now I want to watch it right now.
What's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received?
Oh man. I interned with This Is That in 2003, which is a very formative experience. And that was Ted Hope, Anthony Bregman, and Ann Carey were the three producers. It was the remnants of what was Good Machine, which was my, Good Machine was my like mecca in the 90s. I was like, this is what I want to do. These are the kind of movies I want to make. And this is, they had a good machine. This is the, they had a lot of integrity and a good ethos. Anyway, so I interned with This Is That, which was kind of the remnants of Good Machine. Met Ang Lee there, who's probably my favorite director. Michel Gondry, they were doing Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind at that point. They did that movie. And what was so interesting with that is I've always been kind of this lone cowboy, as I was like describing. And they had found this really good core group of collaborators. And they basically were like, and I think part of the message or advice doesn't hold up as well in this day and age, but it should. It should, if the world was right. They said, like, find good people and find a good place. And the place is the part that maybe doesn't hold up as well, because they had this office and like people would just stop by, you know, like Michel Gondry stopped by for a meeting, and like there was this sense of community and this sense of this filmmaking culture that it's just, it wasn't a scene like in a cool way, but it was just a literal place where amazing people came in every day. And now we're all virtual and zooming and all, you know, split apart. But I think in some ways I wish we get back to that. And also office space is expensive, but basically they had a place and they had good people in that place. And like I remember Ted Hope said, Ted Hope had worked with James Shamus a lot, and some people know who James Shamus is. He ran Focus Features for years. He was like, they had met at NYU, and he was like, I knew like when I first started talking to this guy that he was smarter than me. But he kind of thought I was smarter than him. So we each thought we were smarter than each other. So the great thing was whenever we had an idea, I would run it by that other person. We would bounce ideas off each other. And if we both knew it was a good idea, we knew it was like a good idea. Do you know what I mean? And so that partnership, that, so basically find good collaborators and find a good place or vibe, I think is really, really true. Because in indie film, we don't have money. So our biggest commodity is people. And you're always searching for good people to work with. And that's what'll help elevate, A, get your thing made, and B, elevate it to something awesome.
Do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
You know, it changes with time. Like I used to want to make, you know, giant movies. And I mean, one goal is just direct Star Trek. I was a young nerd. I loved Star Trek so much. Someday I want to direct something Star Trek. But as you get older, it, you know, it does change a bit. And I think right now, especially about to have a kid, I just want to be happy in what I do, treat people well, make good projects that have integrity, both like in what they're saying and the message they're putting out there and kind of the story they're telling, and that move people, but also have integrity in terms of the way they're made and the people you work with. So I basically just want to like make good stuff, work with good people, and have enough money to just like, you know, the basics of life, like feed my kid, put my kid through school, like have a house. You know, it's really simple stuff, but like that is what I want to do. And like, I'd almost rather work on, I'd love to do, I mean, right now, like I think my favorite thing to do, I'm making a movie, so I want to make movies, but it's compared to making some $200 million movie is more like make a really great series for a streamer on like a smaller budget, but that we know is like really great and moves people. I mean, the most beautiful thing I've seen probably on screen in the past, like during COVID for me was Normal People. I just love Normal People so much. And it was so simple. It's mostly two people in a room, and it was just so beautiful. So, because it just felt so real, and it felt like real life. And I kind of cried every episode. So I think making good stuff, doing it well, and then having the basic necessities of life are kind of the main goals. And direct Star Trek.
If you could go back in time, what's the piece of advice you would give yourself?
Funny enough, it's a funny balance, right? People say they don't want egomaniac directors. And I've tried to take that to heart. I'm in general a nice guy, a nice person. So I in general really try to be collaborative and listen. I think in overall, that's a really good thing. But the one thing that I Monday morning quarterback, or the one thing that I go back and kind of kick myself for, are some decisions where I really felt something in my gut as the director. But to be a good person and to work with the team and not be, an egomaniac director, I was like, okay. And I thought about it and I said, okay, let's find a middle ground. Let's either compromise or let's do what you say, other member of the team, which overall you think is a really good instinct. And it really is. It's a good thing to be, but there's a reason, James Cameron there's a reason sometimes you have to be that crazy director. Sometimes you do know. And basically I can think of several calls where I compromised and I really wished I hadn't, because once the movie was finished, I knew if I had just done what I knew in my gut was right, even though the crew would have kind of grumbled or I would have had to, I don't know, it would have been better. So I really feel like you should be collaborative. You should be, discuss. That's a lot of the strength your team brings to the movie is obviously their perspective and their skills and et cetera. But you in the end are the director of your project and you have a vision. And when you know something in your gut is right, I think you should stick to that kind of all the way, because there's a reason that's there, and I'm often a writer director. So maybe it's a bit different too, when you're adapting something or you're directing TV and you're working, obviously you're working with a showrunner and a writing team, but especially when you're a writer director, just nobody knows the material better than you. You've lived with it for so long. And just when you have that feeling in your gut, I think really go for it. Because there are several times where I've outfought my gut, and more often than not, I regret having done that.
I love that advice, because I felt that way after I'm just finishing up my first feature, and I felt that I listened to people too much. And there were some times where I should have, and it was good that I conceded, but in some instances, I definitely should have just done what I wanted to do, what I had written for 4 years. It's like, that was there for a reason. Don't change things last minute. I mean, some things I did change last minute were great, but don't change everything. Anyways.
Well, I would say too, the way you know in your gut is if you have an answer, right? Is if a crew member, the DP, whoever comes to you and says, well, why should it be that way? The instances I'm thinking about, I had an answer. Mm-hmm. And I maybe even said the answer. I said, I think it should be this way because of this. And I was like, but okay, let's. So if you have an answer, if you can answer the question, then I think follow that. If you don't have an answer, but just like, well, just because I said so, then yeah, maybe that's not the thing. But kind of like you're saying, when you live with it for 4 years and no, this is the reason that scene should be that way. This is the reason this beat needs to hit this way. And you have that answer, trust that.
And then final question, is making movies hard?
Yes, but it's hard, it's painful, and there's sacrifice. But occasionally it's wonderful. And I was just thinking of somebody, I can't remember what the example was. There was an example of this and I forgot, but it doesn't matter. The thing is, it does live beyond you. I think that's one of the most beautiful things about making a movie, is you're doing something. Again, who knows if people will watch it, because 90% of the movies before 1940 are lost or whatever, right? But, ideally you make this thing that has a life beyond you, and you put all this blood and sweat into it. But then I hope now, Lebanon, PA was made over 10 years ago, and it's about a young girl considering getting an abortion in central Pennsylvania. And just back when it was in the festival run, I would have people come up to me, young women up to 50-year-old women, who would come up afterwards and kind of after the Q&A and just say thank you for making that film. I had an experience like that. And I just, and I loved your film. And I hadn't really talked about it, or I hadn't really, this helped me process it in a way. And all I can hope is that, 100 years from now, but even just now, somebody finds it on iTunes, some, teen girl or somebody finds this movie and watches it and it speaks to them. And that's kind of the amazing magic of it, that I'll never even meet that person, but it spoke to them and meant something to them. And that's why we do it, right? So that's, it is hard, but occasionally it's worth it.
Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yay. We're done. Okay. I'm going to press. Sorry. Wait, really quickly.
Yes.
How can people support you best? Sell your wares.
So yes, my website for our production company is reconstructionpictures.com. You have links to lots of things there, reconstructionpictures.com. The movies are Lebanon, PA, which is, all these movies are on most of the services. So you got your Vudu, your iTunes, your Google Play, your YouTube, you know, et cetera, either for rental or free. You can, you know, search in your Roku. I know Lebanon, PA is streaming a bunch of places for free, but Lebanon, PA, as in Lebanon, Pennsylvania, A Rising Tide, was just re-released, as Liz mentioned, on many services. It's even still on some cable providers right now. It's on like your on-demand box, it's on digital. All these things are also on DVD. Lebanon, PA is a beautiful Blu-ray for you very few collectors out there. The Blu-ray is the best edition of any of my movies. It's beautiful. And then my new movie is What We Found, and starring Elizabeth Mitchell and James Ranson and some other great people. And yeah, please just check out the movies. And then the final thing I'll say is if you like the movies, you know, get in touch. I'm very much here. So, you know, you can always drop a line on the Reconstruction Pictures website and be like, hey, I saw your movie and I loved it or I hated it or whatever. Because like I said, the reason we make it is to have people respond to it. So I always love to hear what people think if you check it out. But please check out the movies. They're good movies. Got some. They're all solid Rotten Tomatoes, except for Lebanon, PA, which is 50-50. And like I said, it deals with a divisive issue, and it's a divisive movie in some ways. I think that's a big reason why it is so split, because I think in some ways it actually got a great New York Times review, but it's a divisive movie in America. But that's also kind of a good thing.
That's funny that it's exactly 50-50.
It's literally on Rotten.
55%, 44%, whatever, 50-50. That's hilarious.
And if you go read, well, the IMDb reviews are the most, and the Amazon reviews are a great example of that, because there's a lot of like 4 or 5 star and a lot of 1 star. And you can just tell it basically, you know, not always, you can criticize a movie on its own merits, but it mostly comes down to somebody's view on abortion and legal abortion. And there are a lot of people who hate the movie for that reason who are very vocal. Mm. On these things. So if you feel that way, then you know, then great. And if you don't, and you want to check the movie out and maybe give it a good review, you can also do that.
So Liz, what do you remember about our conversation with Ben?
I remember we talked a lot about financing, and then when we stopped recording, I remember Ben asked us, like, did we talk too much about financing and fundraising? And like you and I, that's like, I think I'm going to speak for you for a second and you correct me. It's like my favorite topic. Like I always want to hear how people get the money. So I never think it's too much. And Ben is a lovely human, a friend, and I just enjoy talking to him in general. And after you got off, I think we talked for like another half hour, just me and Ben and just shooting the shit.
Oh, so, wow.
It was a good chat.
Nice. Yeah, Ben's great. I really liked that part of the conversation because, you know, it was like this really affirming sort of thing, because his process is very much my process for fundraising, or was my process the one time I raised money for my feature. And it was really interesting to hear that, like, this guy who's done it multiple times does it basically the same way I do it and will continue to do it roughly the same way that I do it, you know. And it seems like as he has gone along in his career, it's gotten a little easier to raise money. So that was like really encouraging. It's like, oh, by my fifth film, it might be a little easier than it was on my first film. You know, I mean, obviously there's an uphill battle there, but still, I thought it was encouraging. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, yeah, Ben's great. I liked his movie too. It was really cool. I watched it like last year when it came out for his Q&A thing that we did. And yeah, I don't know. I'm sort of surprised that, you know, it did how it did. I thought it would have landed better than it did based off how the quality of the movie.
Well, we'll see. I don't remember, honestly. Actually, I don't remember how it did. I don't even know. Like, I just think of him as like an impressive filmmaker, and I actually haven't like broken that down into specific efforts that he's made. So I think regardless of how it landed, like the sum is worth more than the whole is worth more than the sum of the parts.
Yeah, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, listeners, or Ben yourself, if this is different, but I mean, I remember from the conversation that, like, you know, he had made this switch to genre and like kind of hoped that it would like break open these new doors for him, and that like it did, but like not really as much as he was expecting based off of the switch, you know, of going from, you know, whatever these indie dramas he was making to like more of a genre film, that it wasn't like genre enough, you know, like it was still too much of a drama, you know, to really break into that market in the way that he wanted. I think it was still did well. It just didn't do like, it didn't like the doors didn't bust open the way they expected. But I mean, I guess it goes back to what you said last week about like, you know, our expectations as filmmakers are never within reality. Like we always expect movies to do far better than they're going to. And it's like, maybe that was just the reality for that film. And maybe, I don't know, maybe it, I think it probably is like a smashing success. It's just hard to know what that means these days.
I was thinking about this today, actually. I was thinking that I think people in the film industry must be attracted to gambling in some way. Like, I actually really do not like gambling just because I've never learned card strategy or game theory or anything like that. So I'm just like a mess when I'm playing a game. I'm just like randomly like making decisions that have follow no logic. But I think that there must be some sort of attraction to risk or unpredictability or whatever's at the core of gambling that it, that brings in a lot of investors as well as filmmakers, because I'm attached to these projects and they're out to different companies, and it's like it feels like I'm literally playing roulette and just waiting to see what hits. And it's very strange, the kind of magical thinking you get into when you're in these pitching processes, right? It's like, that's ridiculous for me to just send something out and expect something to come back. That's irrational. But it's this like gambling mentality of like, maybe something will hit, maybe it'll tip. Anyway, I think that goes back to what I said a few weeks ago, which was what you referred to, which is what I call filmmaker delusion. And I think that we all have to have a degree of it to be in this crazy industry.
Yeah. I do like gambling. I'm not like a big gambler or anything, but like, you know, I'll play like whatever, $5, $10 poker games with my friends or whatever. And I play online poker for free without any money attached to it. And I love it. It's great. I bet on football, you know, so I definitely feel like I'm part of that part of it. You know, like, not that I'm gambling on my movies necessarily, but I like the excitement that it's like you're making something that's like really cool and that you love so much, and then it's like always that what if, like, whoa, maybe people will love it, maybe it'll like really resonate with a lot of people, maybe it'll be the thing that, you know, skyrockets my career or opens up even one door, you know. It's like, yeah, but I think now what's happened over the years of making short films, it's like my expectations are a lot smaller. It's like I'm not like, oh, I'm not hoping to like, you know, land a Marvel movie from this or anything. Like, I'm just hoping to like have a meeting with somebody.
Yeah.
Like, if this movie gets me one meeting, that's a humongous success.
Isn't that amazing?
You know?
That, like, but I agree. I'm in the same place where I'm just like, does my bio look better after I make this movie? Like, the bio, right, on my website, like, is it more impressive? Okay, cool. Then I think it's a good decision. Like, the stakes are low, but the risk is high. I'm going to use that as my segue, yeah, to Arik. What do you want to talk about today in our soap dish segment?
So first question, I mean, this is going to be a humble brag and a question. So since our last episode, I've gotten into 3 more film festivals with alternate, you know, Raise the Roof. I mean, feels very good now. Now I can't even be like fake that, like, you know, the movie's not doing okay. It's like, yeah, you've gotten into, you know, over 10 film festivals. Yes. Like, yes, you're doing all right. This is pretty good. Hopefully there's more, but if it ended right now, I'd be like, yeah, all right, this is good. So about half of them are doing live screenings.
Yeah.
I definitely can't go to all of them, but I'm trying to decide like which ones to go to and like how important it is to go to film festivals, because in my mind, like, film festivals are pretty much only worth it if you can go, or that's how I used to think. But I'm not sure if that's true anymore necessarily, especially with virtual film festivals. It's like half of them you can't even go to anyways. But I just want to talk to you about like how important do you think it is to actually go to these film festivals that you get into?
Not to be a broken record, but I'm going to talk about my cheapness again in this episode, which is, if a festival's not offering me something that's going to make it very easy on my pocketbook to travel and attend, then I do not go. Unless it's such a great opportunity that I'm willing to invest the money in, right? And I think that's always the gray area is like, what's good enough of an opportunity for you to spend money? But I always get something out of a film festival. Like, I always get email addresses, relationships. I can remember when I volunteered at the Mill Valley Film Festival, I still remember like the experiences and the connections and the networking I did there. And that was me putting my money forward and donating my labor. But it's all about triage. What do you want to do with your time? So are these festivals offering any sort of stipend, housing, travel?
Yeah. I need to ask all of them, basically, if that's happening or not. I know that Dances with Films is not. They were very clear on that. I asked them that question. But yeah, I have to ask the other ones if they are. And two of them, which I don't think I can announce either one yet, but they're both international. And so it's like, okay, like, can I go to this country? Like, I would love to go to this place. It's amazing. It's incredible. Right. But, you know, it's like, can I even get my passport renewed on time? And then, like, you know, can I go? Which I'm, like, sending my passport off today just in case I can go.
Nice.
Just, like, take care of it. But, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's all tough. But, I mean, I kind of feel like that's sort of part of what you do. And it's not necessarily – you're not going to the film festival to, like, oh, my God, I'm going to meet this agent. Oh, my God, I'm going to meet this, you know, person that's going to change my life, this producer or whatever. It's more like you're going to, like, connect with – the festival and connect with the filmmakers, you know, right. And just like meet new people and kind of, you know, expand yourself as an artist. Cause I think like you learn a lot, you grow a lot when you go to a festival, and especially an international festival, it's like, oh my God, like the kinds of movies I'm going to see there are going to be so different than what I'm used to seeing, you know, here in America. And like also just like in mass media, you know, like the kinds of things that are going to get programmed at a genre film festival in, you know, another country are going to be interesting for sure.
I love how positive you are about that. I just think I've had enough really bad experiences at film festivals where I'll go by myself. I don't know what I'm doing. There's no one overseeing a Q&A with me. You know, I've no transportation, like basically where I'm just like paying for a vacation where I don't get to choose the agenda and I didn't get to choose the country or the state or the city. You know, I just think I've had some bad experiences. And I think you got to think to yourself, like, it sounds romantic to be flown out to, I don't know, I actually don't know where these festivals are, so I'm just going to pick a random country. Being flown out to Poland or being flown out to Spain, right, or whatever it is. It sounds romantic because you're like, wow, they want me and it's far away and it's exotic and it's interesting. But like, if you were not planning to go to that place and if that festival doesn't have the resources to support you, they don't have the resources to make it a good substantial time either, I don't think. So that's what the, so it's not just a cheapness question. It's more like, how organized is this film festival? And are you going to be stuck in another country, lost and confused? Or are you going to get your money's worth for the submission fee and for the investment?
Right. Yeah. You know, I've had plenty of bad film festivals experiences too. I mean, I've only gotten with a short so far, but like, you know, like when you go to a place that you travel to and there's like, whatever, 5 to 10 people in the theater with you, it's like that can be a kind of a defeating experience. But like, you know, if you meet one person, you make one friend, or you see one movie that's interesting from going to that festival, I feel like that kind of makes up for those sorts of things for me. I mean, because you can't control it. Like, you can do as much advertising and press and talking about your screening on social media, but like, you know, you're only going to be able to get so many people to come, you know, to your screenings, right? Especially if it's in a town that you don't know anybody in, you know, like if you're in the middle of America and you're like, okay, I might have 3 Facebook friends who are near this place. It's like, what are you going to do? You know, you just got to go, and you're kind of, you're surrendering yourself to the festival programmers. You're saying, I'm coming. You let them know that you're coming, and you're trusting that they're going to take care of you and that the screening is going to be worth your time, you know. And I've been to enough where it was that I feel like, yes, I will definitely continue to go and just hope that I pick the right ones, you know.
I'm going to have to recommend one film that I think is well worth everyone's time. It's called Official Rejection, and it's made by Paul Osborne. And he's kind of like a well-known indie filmmaker. And he made a movie about being rejected by film festivals for, I think, his first feature. I'm not positive. It's been a while since I've seen the movie. But this movie makes you feel better. It makes you feel less lonely. It makes you feel, and there's like, it turns around. It's not just like him being rejected. It's like some festivals accept him and he goes, he takes you with him on his journey to these different film festivals. And it's through there that I heard about Phoenix Film Festival for the first time, which is my favorite film festival, because they really love filmmakers and they treat you well and they take care of you, but they're also just like kind people. But in that film festival, it's like the worst case scenario is shown, where I think he gets invited to this film festival and it's like a small AV closet in an unmarked building with like no one else there, and even the projectionist is not there, and you're just like, similar things have happened to me. I just would encourage everyone to check it out if you're going through film festival hell.
Yeah, I went to one, I can't remember where it was, but it was like I got there and they were like, we lost your Blu-ray. we can't play your movie. And then like luckily, like I had made a habit of keeping DVDs and Blu-rays of my movie in my car with me, because I heard that this could happen, and then I had one and they were able to play it. But it's like, you know, that's the last thing you want to worry about, is like you're like, can see your movie with an audience and you're like, oh my God, I don't even have the movie. Like, oh my, that's why I worry about the tentacle parts of it, because it's like, anyways.
That's so crazy.
So the next thing I want to talk to you about was, anxiety about premiering your movie. You've had two features premiere, you've also made other movies. And like, I've always get a little bit of anxiety. It's usually on the first screening is the worst. It's like whenever it's being shown to the people for the first time, it's like, I can barely, it's really hard, you know, and I'll sit in the theater and I'll watch it. But like sometimes I put a hood over my head or something, or like sink down in the seat. But like, how do you deal with anxiety and like this feeling of like panic when you're approaching the release of your movie?
What is that a phrase where it's like, it's going to come, I'm going to be confronted with this as a major problem at some point later in my life. It'll come to a head for me, is I fill my anxiety and I channel it to busyness. So what I do is I create things before the screening that keep me busy so I don't have a massive panic attack. So like before each of my screenings, I would go out and greet everyone and I'd give them the merch that I brought or cookies, or I'd just thank them for coming to the screening and I'd shake each of their hands. Like I'd go out there instead of sitting in the audience freaking out, right? And then I'd run in and I'd sit in the back, or I'd go and I'd do the intro. So I'd say the first thing is the anxiety is probably going to be its worst right before the movie starts. So maybe find yourself something to do during that time. And I think the other thing is, so what do? Yeah, you just find other things to think about. You make yourself so busy that you can't confront or deal with any of this anxiety. This is not good advice. This is very unhealthy coping mechanisms. they are not good. But it's what I do. You could sit in it and you could recognize and tell yourself, you know, that this will be over soon. You could write it down and memorialize how you feel. You can do podcasts about it. But
right.
I find that, or you go for hikes, you channel all your extra energy out. I think you recognize that, like, this is part of the thrill of filmmaking, is that nervousness. And it's also why you do it, right? Like, what the alternative is, you being bored. So isn't it a little bit better to be nervous than bored?
Yeah. My nervousness is a little bit different than yours, because it's like it's not the worst it's going to be right now, but it got really bad today. Like I woke up, I stayed up really late making my trailer, teaser trailer for my movie, and like set it off, and I'm pretty happy with it. I got some notes from my team, but like, you know, it's in a good place. But like I woke up super tired and just feeling like I was going to throw up. Like I have so many things to do. It's like not just for this screening, it's like all the assets I need to send in for the movie. Like I got into 3 film festivals last week, so that's like 3 more sets of assets I have to turn in, and then 2 of them are international, so it's like one of them is requiring for me to put subtitles on the movie, and it's like that's a whole thing that I gotta do. And it's like, yeah,
you can outsource that. Just, you hire someone
I'm going to hire somebody, but that's like, you know, more money out of the budget that I don't necessarily have. And then it's like, you know, just another thing I have to do. And so, you know, and then like I need to announce these film festivals, like the ones I can announce, like First Glance Film Festival in Philadelphia, in. So like I gotta like, you know, start like getting the social media engine turning on these things. I also just need to like, you know, be promoting the screening that's on Saturday as well. And so it's like these are the things that are giving me like a feeling of like, oh my God, like I have so many things to do. And so like what I need to do is just like go, like you said, get my energy out, yeah. Go to the gym, yeah. In my little grungy little, you know, gym office that, or gym garage I have now. I got a Muay Thai boxing bag that I put up a few weeks ago. And so like, just gotta go in there, just gotta punch the bag for like 30 minutes, yeah. Like clear my mind, make a list, and just knock the list down and just like get off the things off the list that need to happen.
It's 1,000% what you need to do. And I think I also get the anxiety by the overwhelming number of things that I have to do. It's really dorky, and like what you're saying, make a list. But like, I just bought this notebook. I don't know if you could see it. It's very pink, nice. And it's sparkly. My son picked it out because he likes pink and sparkly things.
Oh, fun.
But the reason I say this is because, yes, you can say, oh, I got to write this down. But like, really, you should all have it in one place and then think of it as like a fun game, which is really stupid to say out loud. But it is what I do, is that like I get a little thrill when I knock something out and I start with all the easy tasks. So I get on a roll. You know what I mean? Like, and then you break all mm-hmm. the long tasks into small tasks. But I think I brought this up in another show, but like whenever I get overwhelmed, I go to Sean and I say, oh my God, there's so much to do and there's no time. And he said, all you have to do is one thing. And I was like, what thing is that? He's like, just one thing. Just get one thing off the list. So I think if you just think about just each thing, not the aggregate, but just one thing that you have to do in that next half hour and just get it done.
Yeah. And that's good advice. Thanks, Liz. I already feel better.
Yay, but I think the boxing's really going to help for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and then I'll also just like removing things from my like week that are voluntary that, yes, I don't have to do.
Get it, clear like, out your schedule. 100%.
Yeah. Just like, you know, you're going to do this thing. It's like it's caused you tons of stress. Like it's going to slow everything down. It's like just get it out. Like you don't need it. You can survive without
this. This is why I don't socialize, though. So I think at some point in a few months, you're going to have to reintegrate those voluntary things where I still have not. I still act like I'm on, running on empty all the time. So.
Oh, speaking of social things, this is like my plan is to like make the movie into as many social events as possible. Yeah. I've got a Bay Area screening that just got announced. a few days ago. We're screening at the Oakland International Film Festival at Jacqueline Square on Thursday. I believe it's September 23rd. I think that's the Thursday. Let me just make sure I got that right. But yeah, everyone who's in the Bay Area, which I know there's quite a few of you because I'm a Bay Area person and there's a lot of Bay Area listeners. You guys should all come. Yes, that is right. The 23rd. 7 p.m. Jack London. Which I argue is too early to be showing it because it's probably still going to be light, but maybe it'll be just dark enough. But anyways.
Oh, it's September. It was getting dark really early last night. We're getting there.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I know it's still light at 6:30, but yeah, maybe by 7 it's dark enough. I don't know. But anyways, hope people can come. That's very exciting. That's like the first Bay Area screening of the movie, and hopefully we're going to get more, but that'll be a fun one. Anyways, Liz, do you think we have time?
I want to end this segment with my favorite film festival story, if I can.
Oh, sure, please.
I'm going to call out the name of this film festival because I'm going to shame them. I got accepted, I don't even know which film it was. I think it might have been my first feature, to Cincinnati Film Festival. I think it was called like Cincy Movie Fest, but it was the Cincinnati Film Festival. And they like completely, they dropped the ball. Like they messed up the screening times or the screening never happened or something horrible happened. And my movie never screened for some reason. And
oh my God.
And I called them on and I was like, what happened? Please tell me what's going on. These things are really important to me. They didn't respond, but they sent me in the mail a used copy of Wag the Dog on DVD.
And they say, sorry,
something like, sorry for what happened. and then it was just a copy of Wag the Dog on DVD.
Here's the movie.
And so part of me thinks that was like some weird code of being like, shit is crazy over here, and Wag the Dog is the only thing that we could, you know, choose to reflect the utter political chaos that this festival is running with. Or it was just like, this is a movie we have on hand and it's used, but it's a gift. Let's send it to this filmmaker because we feel bad. And I like cannot get over this. So that's like my little story that reflects how insane film festivals are. It's like, why would anyone ever do this? Why would anyone ever send a used copy of Wag the Dog to someone else? Doesn't make any sense. Film festivals don't make any sense. Done. Mic
drop. Very, very bizarre. Yeah, I don't know. I there's a lot of film festival stories I could tell, but like I've seen it happen to other filmmakers at film festivals. Like I went to my very first film festival was the Boston International Science Fiction Film Festival, and it was an awesome film festival. But when we got there the day before the screening for my movie, we got there, we go straight to the film festival, we go to one of the short blocks. It's like 10 to 15 people there, maybe, most of them the filmmakers. You know, some of them flew across the country from Los Angeles to be there, you know. And then, like, something happened with the way they are playing the movies, and they lost about half the movies. So, like, half the people's movies who were there to see them didn't get played, and then, like, some of them did. And then, like, some people who were there, like, had to, like, give the Vimeo links to their movies to the people, and then they played them off of a laptop instead of playing it through the other way they were going to play it. And like, it was just a complete disaster. And I was like, oh God, why did I fly to Boston from Oakland to do this? This is so ridiculous. And then like that night we were like so tired from flying. We're like, we're not going to see any more movies tonight. We're just going to get some food and go back to our place. And then I look into the other theater that like is playing one of the features, and it's packed to the brim with people, like all
right,
the way.
That's why we do it, because it's a gamble. Because you didn't know.
Weird.
You, like when you go to a screening, you don't know who's going to show up. You're like, I'm just going to roll the dice. Yeah. I'm going to see if mine is going to be a packed screening or 15 people. Will they play my movie? Yeah. I don't know. Will they send me a copy of Wag the Dog? Maybe. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. And the shorts, like, was the room where the shorts were playing was like not a big theater. It was like a 50 person like little basement theater, you know. And then they had like the big grand ballroom theater with like hundreds of seats. And then the next day we go to my screening, and then, you know, of course it's that little 50 seat theater, but it's packed to the brim with people. Like people are sitting in the aisles all the way up, like jammed as many people as they possibly could for the screening of those shorts. And so it's like the filmmakers on Friday got screwed, I got lucky. It's like, I don't know. This is what happened. So it's like, you know.
Black. You bet on. I don't know. You bet on the color that won.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Or I just got. Those are the cards I got dealt. And I think, like, having that frame mindset of going into film festivals, it, like, makes me more prepared for, like, what will happen or could happen.
It could go,
you know,
sour.
So that's why I always.
So do you want to go regardless if it goes sour? Yeah.
And I kind of do, you know, to as many as I can. Like, I really want to go and be there for the movie and, like, you know, meet some cool people. Anyways, I think we lost our chance to answer this question again.
Wait, maybe. Let's try. Let's try to do it. Just read the question, and we'll just speed answer it.
All right. So, you've got mail. I've got mail. We're doing mail.
My breath catches in my chest until I hear three little words. You got mail.
Finally, this has been like 3 weeks in a row we have not answered this question, but this comes from Eric Parnell. Eric writes, "Hey, Making Movies is Hard team. Big fan of the show, and I'm hoping you can help with an indie film question I have. I'm a commercial director working on getting my first short off the ground. My question is about casting. It seems like a lot of directors on the show talk about how they had great casting directors that were key in the success of their film. I imagine there's not a big casting budget, so I'm wondering where people are finding casting directors that want to cast for experience or do it on the cheap, and also casting directors that have access to actors that would want to work for an ultra-low budget rate. I have agencies we normally work with on commercial projects, but rates are always pretty high for the talent. I'm wondering if there's a specific place I should look or language should you be using to make these inquiries. Any help would be greatly appreciated. Liz, what do you think about this?"
So for what it's worth, I did respond to Ben directly on Instagram. So he's not been waiting for an answer to this question, but we wanted to share it with...
To Eric, right?
To Eric. Why do I think his name is Ben? Eric.
Because Ben was our guest. Was
like, I'm sorry, Ben, Eric, Ben, so sorry. To Eric Parnell. I did respond directly to Eric Parnell. And what I said was, you go for the casting associates and assistants at big casting agencies. They're looking to make a name for themselves, not just as an assistant or an associate. They're sometimes willing to work for slightly lower rates, and they have similar Rolodexes to the larger casting directors that they work for. So they have the same access. That being said, I've never been able to afford a casting director on my projects. It's something that I'm working to do on larger projects. And I ended up casting films myself and just going directly to talent. And what you need to do is you need to have an offer letter written by an entertainment lawyer that is a deal memo. And it's a contractual, you're offering them an opportunity that is written very specifically in legalese that breaks down their rate, what you're offering, the dates, everything like that. And that is the way to kind of jump the casting line. But a great casting director is worth their rate. I just never had the budget. Done.
Yeah. Same, basically. I've tried to get casting directors. I've tried to go after the, you know, new casting directors who are looking to, you know, beef up their resume and everything. And it's, you know, for whatever reason, this has never worked out, you know. And I feel like it's just tough because, like, you know, they're going to know people who they think are great, but they might not be the right people for you, you know, and then they might not be on the level that you're hoping for them to be. And then if you do send out an offer letter, or even just like what I used to do was send out just like letters to the actors directly and then just say, hey, like, are you interested in this? And then send it either through their management or to them directly if the casting director has that direct, contact. And then, you know, every time I've done that, it's like it hasn't worked out, you know. And so, I don't know. It's a lot of work. And I think, especially for a short film, you should be probably spending more time just finding actors that you care about and, like, going to them directly than trying to work with a casting director, because it's just going to be a lot of extra time. And you're probably not going to, you know, find anyone who's that much better than someone who you can find through, like, using the local casting websites and casting programs that they have.
You and I always differ on this point, because I think cast is the most important thing you could have in your film.
It is, but you're not gonna, for a short film, like, are you really gonna be able to afford to hire
someone? I'm out to name cast for my short right now, and I've been talking to like five different established good actors in relation to this project. So yes, it is worth it, but it's really hard. Because at least with the feature, just like you're saying, at least with the feature, you could be like, this is a feature. We're going to release. Here's our release strategy. Here's what you go. With your short, you're like, we will put it up on YouTube and people will see it. Like, it just doesn't have the same cachet or thrill that people will want to sign on
right to. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, what I've done in the past is, like, I've had, you know, local, like he's talking about, he works with casting agents on his commercials. He should go to those casting agents that he's friends with and then just see if they have anybody that they'll recommend for it. Because, like, that's the personal connection to the casting director is the thing that's going to be the best for you to get the best cast or the best involvement in casting your film. So go with the people that you know and the connections that you have. Like, don't try to, like, approach, like, a casting associate on a Marvel movie or something, you know, because are they really going to be able to help you?
Yes.
Whoever they have, I just don't know.
They will.
I think they'll be like, oh yeah, well, my rate is, you know, this is going to cost at least $500 or $1,000 for my casting rate. And that would be an amazing deal. And that's a lot of money. And then what are their cast going to want? They're going to want more than scale. You know, they're not going to just take $100 a day or $125 a day.
I've had a Liz, lot of you think good so? Luck with actors working for scale. So
outlier. You're an outlier. I tried to get, like, we were trying to get, you know, this guy, like, you know, what's his name? Oh, I can't remember his name. But he's like an actor who I think you've said on previous shows are like the low budget, like, you know, people you don't even really want in your movie,
the stunt
type people.
Casting,
and they wouldn't.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't do it for, like, less than $5,000.
Yeah, because,
like,
you don't go to the actors who do things for money with very little money. You go to the actors who do indie content, and then you offer them creative control, a good cast to surround themselves with, you know, I mean, I think there's a lot of different angles, and I talk about this all the time, and I feel like I get really redundant. I think you should try. No matter what, I think you should try. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately, yeah, you can always, you know, cast friends and family or local talent, but that actor will get you to a different stratosphere if you cast properly.
Yeah, potentially. Potentially. We've had some directors on the show who've had, like, you know, these kinds of casts that you're talking about who are, like, well-known faces, you know, who've been in lots of things, and, like, they star in their shorts, and they're amazing. They do a fantastic job, and it does have that, like, oh, wow, you've got, like, a real professional Hollywood actor, like, in your movie. But it's like, where does this movie end up? It's, like, 10,000 views on the internet, and that's it. You know, it's like, yeah. You know, I made a short with zero cast, and, like, you know, just completely unknown people, and, like, it's got, you know, over 200,000
hits. But you made it
online.
Genre.
And it's like,
so you, when you're making a film, we're gonna say this till, like, the end of time, right? Is, like, you need something to help you separate from the pack. It's either genre, cast, or something really shocking or zeitgeisty about the subject material. So I think you got genre and probably zeitgeisty with your film.
Yeah, I did. Well, so that I had, like, a Star Trek angle that I used for promoting it, and that seemed to really work, you know, which is funny that that worked so well. And, like, the movie, like, kind of has a Star Trek sort of thing
this
to
is
it.
Strange
Anyways,
thing, right? This is
yeah. Strange Thing, right? Yeah. Yeah, they're, like, Star Trek fans, and, like, the movie's based on a Star Trek episode that's super famous, and the monster's based on the Star Trek monster, you know, so I feel like these sort of things, like, I was able to put that in the materials I sent out to people, and I think that's one of the reasons why, like, it got picked up, you know, by this one site that kind of boosted it to, it's like, whatever it was, 40,000 in the first 2 weeks or something like that, you know?
You were smart, and you were strategic, and you tried, and you were audacious. So be audacious,
yeah,
Eric Parnell.
That. And Liz, I really hope that I have better luck with actors in my upcoming projects, that, like, I get these wonderful, I mean, your cast, like, God, so jealous. Like, you have some of the best actors I've seen out there in your movies. And it's like, you know, I used to think, like, yeah, I could be like Liz and do it too. I wrote, like, 10 different letters to cast, you know, trying to do the thing that you were doing. And, you know, basically what ended up happening was either no response or, yeah, let's make this an offer. The low end, this is, like, the lowest they'll do it for. And it's, like, way out of our budget, you know? And it's like, oh, well, how can we offer scale when you just told us they won't do it for less than X a day? You know, yeah. It's like, it's not going to work.
I get rejected all the time, though. What you see in the casts that I do are, like, the result of years of me, like, I told you know the story about right. pushing off 8 months for Ann Dowd. I mean, I tell the story of, like, getting rejected over and over again by agents and managers. It happens all the time. So the picture that gets painted is like, oh, I just get these actors, but ultimately I just, like, never stop, and I just keep on trying, and I somehow worm my way in there.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing to keep in mind, is that, like, it's not just like, yeah, you didn't approach Ann Dowd or, you know, Bobby Moynihan on your first, you know, your first outreach. Like, that was, like, years and years or lots of time of trying to secure.
And it's
cast,
leveraging one actor for another. I mean, it is just like a game. It is a chess game. So maybe I'm not great at chess, but maybe I'm better at a game like chess than I am at, like, really cool games like poker, where I don't understand them.
Right, yeah, you were good at the game of chess when putting cast together for your films. Yeah,
casting
very
chess.
Exciting. I can't wait to hear who you get to be in your short film. Hopefully you'll be able to announce it.
We'll
soon.
We'll see. I'm waiting. Any day they'll reject me, and then I'll find someone else. So we'll see what happens.
And then that person will say hopefully. Yes. So if you want to be like Eric Parnell, you can send us a question or comment or suggestion to podcast@mickeymoviesisheart.com. Or if you liked the show, you can leave us a review on iTunes. We had like a stream of, like, reviews come in, like, you know, like 3 a month in 1 month or something. And now it's crickets. So people, if you're finding the show for the first time and you're liking the words that we're saying, there's a place where you can tell us about that. You can also go to our YouTube page and leave a comment or question. And lastly, you can support us on Patreon at www.patreon.com/mmihpodcast and give what you can. Thanks in advance. And finally, check us out on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at mmihpodcast. And yeah, Liz, take us out.
Thanks to everyone for listening. Thanks to Ben Hickernell for coming on the show. Thanks to Eric Parnell, who has a similar name, and his name is not Ben. It's Eric Parnell. Check out our website, makingmoviesishard.com, where you can find links to the things we talked about on all the episodes from 1 to 330? 302. Wait, I thought that we were past that point. Oh, you're saying that we're not caught up. Okay. Let me just spell that out for everyone. I'm so sorry. We are working on a new website, and we'll let you know when that's up. We have some big changes coming our way in the next few weeks, so stay tuned. Thanks to editor Cameron for doing the editing. Thanks to everyone for listening. Talk to y'all next week.
Ultimately, ultimately, Cameron, please. I'm just going to do it again.
I love how you're like bargaining with Cameron as if like.
Like he won't do it. Well, he leaves stuff in sometimes. Anyways, 3. This is for real this time, Cameron.